The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Natalie Nahai, and this week's show is sponsored by Squarespace. To discover the simplest way to build beautiful websites, just go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show. This week, more and more technology is being used to help treat mental illness. From Fitbits that monitor the sleep patterns of patients with schizophrenia and apps that help you manage your mood to online therapy sessions, tech is increasingly being seen as a viable alternative to traditional techniques. But is it too good to be true? We'll be finding out how they work, if they work, and the risks involved. We'll also be discussing how our use of tech could come at the expense of our mental well-being in the first place. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So there's often a lot of media hype around the use of tech, and social media in particular can be linked to depression, narcissism, and how we feel about ourselves. We hear about this a lot in the press. I spoke to psychologist Tomas Chamorro-Pramuzik about the risks he believes are posed by social media and technology.
If narcissism is fire, Facebook is gasoline. So people wouldn't have gravitated towards Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat if they hadn't been narcissistic in the first place, by which I mean, you know, if they hadn't had this desire to broadcast their lives, to behave like celebrities and share personal information about themselves as if it's really interesting, and also seek positive feedback from others that reinforces their kind of self-concept and self-esteem and perhaps self-centered needs. Now, it is also true that if you throw gasoline into the fire, you know, I mean, these inherent tendencies, narcissistic tendencies that were there in the first place will become more exaggerated. And research has shown this. Research has shown, very simple summary of the studies is that the more narcissistic you are, the more time you are likely to spend on these various social networks. But at the same time, the more time you spend on these social networks, the more narcissistic you become.
Mm. So really, it's a snowballing effect.
Exactly. And the depression one is a different kind of phenomenon. It's the fact that a lot of people spend so much time following or snooping on others on social media, and they're unaware of the fact that the people that they are seeing there are not the real people they know. And because most people portray themselves in an unrealistically positive vein, and Facebook and other social networks encourage the suppression of negative emotions and reward the presentation or display of positive emotions, it makes people miserable and depressed to see others as so happy, because you compare yourself to others and you're like, why aren't I so successful, so good looking, or so, you know, happy?
Mm. Okay, so when we're talking about tech and also about the impact of technology on our behavior, I think something that's, again, garnering quite a lot of attention is the impact of screen time on well-being, on performance, on cognitive ability and development when we're looking at younger people. And there was an interesting piece in Ars Technica that cited two separate studies that have been conducted in the US. The first was by Common Sense Media, which looked at just under 3,000 US children aged 8 to 18 about their media habits. And they found that teenagers were spending about 9 hours a day online with media, and tweens, so 8 to 12 year olds, were using media for about 6 hours a day. So this is within quite a substantial amount of time. And then also a time in which they'd probably be better off outside playing or socializing in person with other people. Do you think that there's an impact there on, for instance, being able to read emotional cues or being able to form relationships in a way that's deep and meaningful? Is there anything to suggest that that's starting to be compromised because of our use of screens and tech?
So we don't have solid or reliable data on this yet, but at least conceptually, it would make sense. We all come to the world with a set of really basic and rudimentary skills that are developed or nurtured when they are put into practice, or when we interact with the right triggers of these skills in the environment. So much like growing up isolated from others in a basement will lead to not having many social skills, if you grow up in the digital world mostly and you don't have much time to practice face-to-face interaction, you probably won't develop many people skills. The other thing that is, of course, problematic is that, you know, if people were spending 6 or 10 hours online reading books or getting educated. You know, you could argue at least they're developing intellectual skills or intellectual curiosity, but that's not the case. You know, at most they can spend 18 minutes on a TED talk, which will give them, you know, more, it's edutainment rather than education. So it's the stuff that people do when they're online that is most problematic.
Mm. And what about things like the sensory input that we receive? So for instance, if you've got very young children, age 6 to 12 months to 18 months, who are looking at screens instead of looking out and developing depth of field, what might that do for their development potentially in the longer term?
One could argue that if for them adaptation to the world will be even more technologically mediated, it's okay, you know. So it would only be a problem if you put them in a farm, ask them to hunt animals or make them, force them live in an Amish community. So, you know, in that sense, the average five-year-old today is better equipped to interact with much of the industrialized world than a 60-year-old or 70-year-old, you know, because they can pick up any gadget and they know how it works. So I think the main deficit is around social and emotional skills. Connecting through people via technology is very different than having an effective face-to-face interaction. And so until this date, for example, we haven't worked out a way in which people can reproduce via technological means. You know,
the fact that maybe we will,
and maybe virtual reality can generate this in the future. But you know, it's been pointed out many times that there are now more iPhones being sold every year, every day, not just every year, than people being born. And this difference between these two numbers keeps increasing. I think probably there is a causal relationship. You know, the more people, the more time people spend on their smartphones or interacting with technology, the less time they have for physical interactions with others. So until we work out how to do certain things online, I mean, offline is the way to go. And most people now, young people, don't have these capabilities to develop certain skills in the physical or analog world.
So that's one side of the coin. Coming up next, we'll find out how tech is used to treat our mental health.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK. One snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
So we've heard how tech can have adverse effects on our mental state, but how is it being used in a positive way to help us? With us in the studio today to discuss, we have psychotherapist Dr. Gillian Isaacs-Russell, author of new book, Screen Relations, The Limits of Computer-Mediated Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. We also have Dr. Richard Dobson, who's head of the bioinformatics at the NIHR Biomedical Research Centre for Mental Health, and the tech team's own Hannah Jane Parkinson. Welcome, everybody. So, Gillian, may I start with you? So you're a practicing psychotherapist. How do you find that tech has affected your profession? So maybe with the advent of remote online therapy, should we start there?
Yes. Well, I actually have done quite a bit of technologically mediated treatment, partly because I moved from the UK in 2008 to a remote area in the Black Hills of South Dakota, but wanted to keep practicing. And so I attempted to use a platform like Skype in order to see patients and thought that it was going to really help me to avoid any of the pitfalls of space, distance, time. I could just be anywhere, anytime. And what I discovered and what led to my research and this book was that there are some very distinct differences between working on the screen and working co-presently in the room.
So we're all familiar with this idea of traditional Jungian psychoanalysis of lying back in a room on a couch and having our dreams interpreted and being in relationship present with the psychotherapist. But that's not the kind of therapy that we're talking about when we're talking about screen-mediated therapy. What have you seen in terms of the change and possibly the use of CBT with screen-mediated technology, and why is it suitable for online use?
I think that the therapies like CBT or positive psychology, self-help, could be very appropriate for online use because they are didactic. They aren't based in a relationship. And the kind of talking therapies that you were referring to earlier are actually very strongly anchored in having a relationship. So if you're actually giving instructions to someone, if you are teaching them something, then of course it can be communicated through a screen. But if you are actually having to pay attention to the implicit nonverbal part of the relationship, which we must do, then it doesn't come across in the same way. 60% of our communication is nonverbal and implicit. And actually, informatics researchers themselves, that is, specialists in information via technology, are talking about the fact that these kinds of implicit communications can't be carried over a screen at the moment, two-dimensionally.
So do you think that there are risks associated with the more didactic kind of instructive practices like cognitive behavioral therapy, where the patient is getting a list of instructions? Are there risks kind of taking that approach? Can this treatment kind of mask or even potentially worsen real problems?
I think that some of the risks may be that because we're not in the same room, we can't see the whole body. If you've ever worked on screen, you know that it's usually from the shoulders up. We're not able to see a lot of the intimate things that are going on with our patients. And so that means that, for instance, if someone is struggling with an eating disorder, it's going to be very difficult to see where they are in that, which could be dangerous. Also, of course, you're talking about working at a distance. And if you're working at distance with people, then you may not have crisis or emergency procedures in place.
Hannah, I'd really like to bring you in here. What's your experience of remote counselling? Do you have any experience of it, and can it be useful?
I do have some experience of remote counselling. I'm coming from the other side as a patient here. I have bipolar affective disorder, so I have a therapist now, a psychodynamic therapist on the NHS. My main experience with remote counselling and therapy, non-face-to-face, is I lived in Oxford for a few years, and the Warnford Hospital, there's a big research hospital. Their team pioneered a service which is a text-based system. So it was web and text. You would go, you would track your moods, and then you would sign in. You'd have a login that only people who were being treated there could go on, and it would chart your mood episodes. And it was over a period of time, and it would come out with this kind of graph, and it was supposed to be a means of, you know, seeing over time, especially when bipolar is a cyclical disorder, and you learn to kind of manage your moods by you know, seeing what triggers or what catalysts happen. So that was something that I used in Oxford a few years ago. I also, when I accepted my diagnosis, I think, and started to realize that people don't usually jump about on cars, I, you know, researched into a lot of things, looked into a lot of things, and there were a few mood apps that I used. But I feel the community element was one of the biggest things that I found helpful. There used to be what was the Manic Depression Fellowship, I think, which is now Bipolar UK. They had a very kind of early message boards sort of things, and there's a couple of apps as well that were good. But I think what Gillian said is really, really important, because my therapy that I have now, I have it once a week. It took so long to get that on the NHS, because now they have this IAPT thing, which is about increasing access to therapies, and most of that money is going to CBT, which I think is a great thing in itself. But there's a lot of phone counselling, and we did a huge piece on it the other day in the paper. This woman said something which was, she felt almost the loneliest that she'd ever felt being counselled via a screen. So she felt really, you know, she had very serious depression, and actually there's this moment where she, you know, was being kind of counseled on screen. And I think being with a therapist, you know, there's so many things that happen, as you say, body language, transference, all of these things. If I go in and I'm really annoyed at my therapist and I'm so rude to her, it's like there's something else going on here, and we can work through that.
I'm curious to ask, just before we move on, that you mentioned about online communities. What was it about the online communities that you use that you found helpful?
I think especially at the beginning, when you don't really understand, I think, what's happening a lot of the time with these, when you first become ill or you experience conditions your moods changes, you have to sort of educate yourself, and it can be very enlightening, I suppose, or helpful to talk to other people who've had similar experiences. And then there also is obviously this stigma element, and sometimes it's like, well, who do I speak to in that regard? So you have this, you know, if you have this ready-made kind of bunch of people, and most of the time, especially they're all kind of depressives, they're all up at 3 a.m. in the morning like you are, so that's great. I suppose because there's so many more people in these communities, you can go to certain threads, or there will be certain, you know, and now we have a lot of like trigger warnings and stuff online. There are different sections. So I think especially if you live in a rural area, or you live somewhere where there's not a lot of people, or you have a family that is culturally not that understanding of mental health issues, or is quite dismissive, then they can be. Yeah. And I mean, you know, tech companies, I think, could be doing a lot more on this. Facebook now have that notification system with the if people are kind of posting messages that, you know, implies that they're suicidal or they're feeling down, they've now started to make it easier for people to notify. So internet can be a horrible place, but it can be a very supportive place too.
So Gillian, what do you think about having this kind of mixed approach to therapy and to counselling?
I think that's very useful and very interesting, because obviously we need to look at both the gains and the losses of technology. And the gain is some of the things that you said, an online community, being able to have feedback about your moods. But at the same time, I think it's really important to also listen to what you said, which is that being in the room and being contained is key. And I think that the danger here is that financially, we're going to opt to bring everything online and lose the sense of two human beings in the room, because it's cheaper and because it's more convenient. So I think that's really something to be careful of, and to keep that careful balance that you were talking about.
Great. Okay, so coming up next, how assessing and treating our mental health could change in the future. That's after this.
Squarespace. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Welcome back. So, looking to the future, how can we change the way we evaluate and treat mental health? Dr. Richard Dobson uses big data approaches to gather clinical data from patient records and lifestyle data taken from wearable tech, which I'm sure we're all fairly familiar with now. So, Richard, why is this approach useful?
I think this approach is useful because there is a lot that happens to a patient during their timeline, if you like. And we know very little about that. We know very little about them over this disease continuum, other than the snapshots that we see when they appear at the clinic in front of a clinician. And then you have a very subjective report of what is happening to the patient at a particular time. They're very irregular, very sporadic. So I think we can use technology to improve that communication over that continuum, so that we can look at people at risk, we can look at early diagnosis better, and then we can help manage people better when they're post-diagnosis, and look for relapse, treatment response, etc. So that's really what the work is all about that I'm trying to do. And we're able to take data from lots of different sources in order to be able to do that. So electronic health records being one of those data sources, using genomics, molecular data, for example, using wearable devices data, and any other data that we can get our hands on, really.
So when you're talking about things like tracking genomics, so looking for biomarkers in the blood that are indicators of certain diseases or particular things like Alzheimer's and schizophrenia, what kind of apps are available that enable you to track these things better, and how do you protect the privacy of the data of your patients?
So we're at the early stages of identifying biomarkers for early Alzheimer's, for example, or treatment response in schizophrenia. So we're just really looking to see whether we can find these signatures in blood, which are indicative of changes that are happening in the brain. Obviously, that, you know, two very different tissues. In Alzheimer's disease, there is a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, and so we expect that there might be some signal that leaks through into the blood, for example. But that's very early stages. In terms of privacy is incredibly important and something that we're constantly aware of. When we're thinking about electronic health records, for example, that is a relationship that person has had with the clinician and that's been put to paper. And so we have a very strict governance around what happens with that data and how we can use that data. And all of that governance is patient-led. Patients are engaged all the way through the design of that governance model. And then they're part of it. There's a patient-led committee which monitors and approves everything that's done with that data. So that's crucial and incredibly important.
Okay, so how's this big data approach so far? Because I know it's fairly young still. Has it thrown up any really interesting trends?
I think it has. I think if you think about clinical trials, for example, clinical trials test a drug on a very small group of people, on a very narrow group of people that are very kind of selected, if you like, and that drug is then put out into practice. Whereas, you know, getting access to data in electronic health records, for example, gives us potentially a huge amount of information on how this drug actually works in reality, you know. And that information's been locked away, and that's crucially important information for knowing how this stuff really works.
So it potentially provides a much more naturalistic...
It's a naturalistic trial, yes. That it enables.
I want to ask you maybe a little bit about your sleep site study, which uses Fitbits for people with schizophrenia. Can you tell us about that and the potential benefits that you're seeing in that research?
We're very interested in wearables and devices generally. Obviously, there's a distinction between medically approved devices and these kind of cheap, throwaway, almost consumer devices. And actually, we're focusing on those at the moment because, you know, they may have utility. If we go back to the point that if we're looking at patient interactions with a clinician being very sparse and sporadic, this kind of device allows us to have continuous, pervasive, deep monitoring of patients potentially in the community continuously. And so for schizophrenia, this is important. We have schizophrenics come in, they're seen and they go back out into the community, and then they may not be seen again until they relapse. And there's a high proportion that do relapse in a year, in the first year. And so if we're able to do something that enables us to target those individuals that are potentially going to relapse, we can intervene and prevent that happening. And there's a cost saving and there's a benefit to patients there. And so we're looking at using these cheap devices with the phone information. Phones are loaded with sensors, using these devices to monitor sleep in these patients, because sleep is an early indicator of potential decline.
So you're actually talking about preventative healthcare, bringing people in, providing possible support before they get to a position where they actually need a huge amount more in terms of intervention?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so Hannah, we've already mentioned that you're familiar with some mental health trackers, and you've tried them. How effective did you think they were for you, bearing in mind we're not talking about schizophrenia in your instance, but about other particular things?
It's a bit, you know, like New Year's resolutions in January, and you say, oh, you'll go to the gym and you'll be really good and, you know, you'll be... not be late for work. And again, I think when I accepted this diagnosis and started to work really hard as well with my psychiatrist to come up with the right medication and combination, and that's when I downloaded all these apps and thought, okay, you know, I'll get my life together. And that was when I started to download a lot of these apps and kind of engage with them. And I had about, you know, five different mood trackers, which started to stress me out a little bit. And then I had to get these notifications five times a day, like, oh, you know, how are you feeling now? And put your thing. And I would always be like, well, annoyed because you keep interrupting me by saying, how do you feel now? How do you feel now? So when you're a kid and your parents are like, well, what's school like? You just chill. So I did use them a lot. And then I think what often happens with certain mental health conditions is that when you start to feel better, you what is termed compliance can sometimes go down in that you think, for instance, oh, I'm not going to take my medication now because I'm fine and you know, I don't need it. And then I started to kind of fall off, as I say, with any sort of resolutions, and I stopped using these trackers because I suppose they were, again, it was my impetus to use them. And that's, as we were saying earlier, when you have, you know, a clinician who has a strong bond to you and there's that combination, and they can kind of ask whether you're using those things and if they're relevant in your sessions, and if you use that data, then that's when it becomes more integral. For me, I don't use those moods apps or trackers now, but I would do again. I think if, say, Camden, Islington, where I am, if they were signed up to this Buddy app, then I probably would use that in conjunction with my therapist.
Gillian, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I was just going to say that research has shown that human contact is what keeps people motivated to keep using the apps. So, it actually is exactly what you're saying, that if you are using them simply remotely without any human contact, you are going to be less motivated to continue.
So talking about connection with other people, Richard, coming back to you, one of the biggest problems that you must face is integrating some of this fairly promising modern technology into rather antiquated and unwieldy hospital systems, and also changing the culture that exists in these institutions. How is this something that you can address to help people use stuff which potentially is quite valuable in terms of getting positive changes in their patients?
So it is tough. It is really tough. If you think the NHS infrastructure is creaking to a large extent in terms of tech, and you know, the focus there really is just keeping it afloat, keeping it alive. So then how do you develop a different stream of business almost that allows you to develop and implement innovation? It's really tough because there's just not really the infrastructure to enable that, or the room capacity to be able to do it. And so we've tried to develop a lot of innovation and to try to put that in, and it was really, really hard to get any kind of traction. But I think the key thing here was really actually, rather than thinking about what we thought was going to be really useful, we had to make everything clinician and patient-led. Okay, so we had to go to them, and rather than say, we've just done something really fantastic, you're going to love this, try it, or rather than saying, actually, don't write in the free text, fill these boxes out for us because that's more convenient for us, that just doesn't wash at all. So we went to them and went to patients and said, actually, we'll do hack days. You tell us what you want and we will do it. Okay.
So kind of empowering your clinicians and your patients to engage with the process and shape it to an extent.
Yeah. It has to be totally driven from that side.
So how far away do you think we are from actually getting to a point where these sorts of apps and technologies are integrated into the NHS?
Well, I think it is happening. There are huge initiatives and small initiatives to enable this. We have a Centre for Translation Informatics, which is a unique relationship between the hospital and the university. There are institutes such as the FHIR Informatics Institute, which is getting a huge amount of weight behind it. These big projects are being set up to actually change the systems that we're working within.
So just to round off then, I'm going to ask each of you, what do you think are the most encouraging bits of technology that can help us become more empowered, whether it's a specific health condition or maybe sleep patterns that we want to improve? So maybe I'll start with you, Hannah. What do you see being promising in the way of tech?
What I would hope is promising and what I would really like is I'm testing a bunch of sleep products at the moment for our Tech Monthly issue, which is available in all good shops in The Observer. I have quite bad sleep problems, and as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, that sleep is one of the big markers for mental health, and that is often what triggers my certain moods. If I'm in a kind of manic mood, I would sleep a lot, and if I'm in a down phase, I will sleep, you know, up to kind of 20 hours a day. So the regulating sleep cycle is so like really, really important for managing mental health conditions, and I would really hope that sleep technology and things that we can use in our home, as Richard said, not really cheap things that you buy online from Argos but actually do nothing, but things that substantially work. I really hope that comes along. At the moment, the thing, like this morning, I wore for 50 minutes like these glasses with kind of green light, and they're supposed to adjust your circadian rhythm. So I don't know how that's going to go. I have to work that. I have about 20 alarm clocks with different seagull noises and various things. I'm just kind of trying everything, and one doesn't want to be kind of reliant on Zopaclones or kind of sleep medication. So it would be great if in conjunction with, you know, exercise and eating right and not looking at screens and all of the stuff that we're supposed to do for better sleep health, if tech could actually help with that rather than be a hindrance, which quite often it is.
So watch this space with the tech that you've been trialling. Yes. Gillian, how about you?
I would think that it would be the way we would use technologically mediated communication. There are people who live in very remote areas who are out of reach of help. And in that case, I think that it's a blessing that somebody can actually be there for them to do the actual therapy that they might need, as long as we don't confuse better than nothing with good enough.
Great. Richard, how about you? Final word.
I'm very excited about the change in culture. If we think about what happened with the National Programme for IT and things like that, the change towards the acceptability of open source, of technology, and actually, you know, seeing that stuff go into practice and that NHS appetite for innovation and adoption, which is really growing. I'd love to just see these things being used for real-time decisions and interventions.
It's a very, very promising space. Well, that's all we have time for this week. A big thanks to all my guests today, to Dr. Gillian Isaacs-Russell and Dr. Richard Dobson, to Dr. Tomas Chamorro-Promuzic, and also to Hannah Jane Parkinson. I've been Natalie Nahai. You can follow me on Twitter, at Natalie Nahai. This week's producer was Simon Barnard, and thank you very much for listening. We will be back again next week.
The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.